I come much closer, my voice is rather quiet.
Closer is better.
Namatu Ratanatayasa. Good evening, everyone. Thank you all for coming tonight. And thank you for inviting me to give a talk. It's great to see that you start your evening off with meditation. Come closer. I can try to speak louder, but I have a very quiet voice. You have to come very close. So, studying the Dhamma, listening to the Dhamma, it's like reading a map. You get to figure out the path. You get to learn what is the path and which direction to take. But if you just study, if you just listen, if you don't actually practice, I think I'm preaching to the choir, you all know what happens. You can have a very souped up sports car, but if you don't take it out and drive it, it doesn't serve any purpose. The Dhamma is the same. You can learn the Dhamma, you can study the Dhamma, but if you don't practice it, it doesn't have any benefit. So they have to go together. In fact, in the Buddha's time, when listening to the Dhamma, they would actually meditate as well. So they wouldn't just listen to try to understand intellectually, but they would listen to try and practice at the same time. So I encourage you, when you listen to the talk, sometimes I'll close my eyes. You're welcome to close your eyes and meditate through the talk. It's a prime time to actually deeply understand and penetrate the Dhamma and to understand yourself, because you're constantly brought back to the Dhamma by the speech. So tonight I'd like to talk about the path. I just said that you can read a map, and you study the Dhamma, it's like reading a map. You get to learn the path. So tonight I'd like to talk about the path. The Buddhist path. The Buddhist path it has a specific name. It's called the Visuddhimagga, which means the path of purification. So we have the Buddha's words. Sabbe saṅkhāra anicchāti yadāpanyāya pasati attha nibindati dukhe esa maggo visuddhiya. It's Pali, but the Buddha talks about impermanent suffering and non-self. He says all formations are impermanent. All formations are, all sankhara, are dukkha. And all dhammas are anatta, are non-self. And this isn't just theory. He says, "Atta, then, yada panyaya pasati, when you see this with wisdom, you don't just think about it and study about it, but when you see it with wisdom, atta nibindati dukhe, and become disenchanted with things that don't satisfy, that can't satisfy. You become disenchanted with all the things that we cling to. You let go of them. And you learn to be flexible and content with life as it changes, as things come and as they go. Esa mago visuddhiya. This is the path to purification. So he talks, this is how he describes the path, as being to purity. So this is what I'd like to talk about tonight, the path of purification. I talked about this before, I talk about this often. It's really a very core and deep topic. It's something that you wouldn't want to teach to people who weren't meditating. If you haven't practiced meditation, it's very difficult to understand. So that's why I encourage, even when you're listening to this, close your eyes. Take it as a meditation practice, guided meditation. So we'll try. I won't be able to take you through the Visuddhimagga, but I'll describe it to you so that you know where you're going. This is the Buddha said, he just points the way. He can't take you. He can't lead you to Nibbana, but he can point the way. It's up to you to walk. So the Visuddhimagga has seven parts. It shows up in the Tipitaka for those of you who are interested in the Ratha Vinita Sutta, Majjhima Nikaya number 24, I think. If you're interested in that kind of thing, it's in there. Sariputta is discussing it with Punamantaniputta, I think. And Puna says that these seven purifications, they lead one to the other, like relay chariots, or like a series of carts, of vehicles that you take. You get into one vehicle and you drive it until it breaks down, or until the horses pulling the chariot become tired, and then you switch into the other vehicle. In ancient times, this is how the kings would travel long distances. Because horses, you could only push them so far, and then they would be tired, and you'd have to take another set of horses. So they'd have relay chariots. And so the Dhamma is like this. It's not one purification, not one practice. It's actually seven practices that lead one to the other. So if you say, what is the path that you're practicing? It's actually quite complicated, quite difficult to explain. This is what Sariputta was saying. He asked him, is it for this? Is this the path? No. Is this the path? No. Well, is it something else? No. He asked seven things. He said, these seven things, are any of these the path? He said, no. So Sariputta said, well then, is it something else? He said, no. And so Punna had to explain. He didn't even know it was Sariputta, the Dhamma, quite well, and Sariputta wanted to meet him. And Punna didn't know that he was talking to the Buddha's chief disciple. And so he taught Sariputta. He thought this was just some ordinary monk. So he taught him the relay chariots, these seven things, seven purifications. So that's a little background, gives you some idea of the importance of these, and gives you some idea of what we mean by the path of purification. We talk about seven purifications. They go in order. If you're interested as well, this is the basis of the great commentary, the Visuddhimagga. It's the name of a commentary on the Buddha's teaching. It's a very large work and has, it goes through the seven purifications in quite some detail. I'm only going to give you a brief outline. So the seven purifications in order, give you an idea of what these are. The first one is sila visuddhi, purification of ethics or morality, purification of conduct. The second is citta visuddhi, purification of the mind or mind state. The third is ditthi visuddhi, purification of view. Number four is kangha vitarana visuddhi, purification by overcoming doubt. Number five is magga maggajnana dasana visuddhi, purification by discerning what is and what is not the path. Number six, Patipada Jnana Dasana Visuddhi, purification by knowledge and vision of the practice. And number seven is Jnana Dasana Visuddhi, purification through knowledge and vision, through final realization. These are the seven purifications. This is what I'll be explaining to you. You don't have to remember them, I'll go through them. Sila visuddhi, purification of conduct. Everything begins with sila, right? In Buddhism, this is where it starts. Once an angel came to see the Buddha, angels were want to often come and see the Buddha in the middle of the night. And they would ask him very abstruse questions about the Dhamma, very difficult questions. And the Buddha would answer their questions. So this angel asked, Anto jata pahi jata jataya patita jata. Tang tang go tamapuchami ko imang vichataye jata. The inner tangle and the outer tangle. This generation is entangled by a tangle. It's all tied up in knots. We ask Gotama, the great Gotama, Ko imang vichataye jatam, who will untangle this tangle? We're all tangled up inside and out. Outer tangle, we're tangled up with other people, with conflict with others, or romantic involvement with others, or with power, competition, that kind of thing. We're oppressed, or we oppress others, we're condescending, patronizing. All kinds of tangles with other people, conflicts and attachments to the world around us, tangled up in money, tangled up in our possessions, tangled up even in our body, is the outer tangle. And the inner tangle is in our minds. We're tangled up by greed, tangled up by anger, tangled up by delusion, tangled up by worry, anxiety, fear, depression, conceit, arrogance, lots and lots of tangles. So who can untangle this tangle? The Buddha said, Sile patithaya. This is how our discussion begins. This is how our path begins. standing upon sila. Sila means conduct. When someone is dusila, they have poor conduct. Conduct means the physical and the body and the speech. Our acts of body, our acts of speech. The things we do and say. These are the outer manifestations of karma, of our deeds. When we want something, we chase after it. When we don't like something, we run away from it. When we try and build the things we want, we try and destroy the things we don't want. The body and the speech is the most gross form of karma that there is. When you do something to hurt someone else or to manipulate someone else, you say things to hurt them or to manipulate them. This is the most extreme form of what we might call evil that exists in the world. When we do evil deeds or say evil things, things that hurt others. This is the most gross form of impurity. And it's impure because it hurts us. It doesn't just hurt the other people. It hurts our own mind. We suffer from our impurities. When you hurt others and then you try and sit and meditate, you remember all these things. When you sit down and meditate, your mind becomes settled, and so anything that is any stress, any conflict, any tangle that there is in the mind, if you've hurt other people or other beings, if you've spoken badly to others, you'll feel guilty about it. So our practice has to start with morality. We have to keep rules. We have to have a set of ethical rules to live by. Not to kill, not to steal, not to cheat, not to lie, not to take drugs and alcohol, not to harm ourselves or others. To keep our minds free from the effects of acts and speech that is impure, that distracts us, that upsets the mind. Otherwise, when you sit, you'll never see clearly, you'll never be pure, your mind will never be calm or clear or quiet. So, actually with morality, with ethics, it's quite easy, because when you sit down to meditate, you're already quite ethical. You've already begun the practice. Ethics, you accomplish it when you sit down and close your eyes. That's what meditation really is. It's ethics. It's the most ethical activity. Your body, what are you doing with your body? You're refraining from any type of distracting activity. Not just killing and stealing, but anything. If a mosquito lands on you, you just be mindful of it, or you brush it off needlessly. You don't have to worry about telling the truth because there's no opportunity to lie. Meditation is the most ethical activity there is. So this one, we're all right now. And this is actually meaningful, because as you practice this ethical activity, your mind starts to calm down. You're not distracted by all the actions and speech that normally would distract deeds, those modes of speech that are harmful. You start to see the harm in them because you're quieting down. This is very important. It's the basis. So this is why it's important to meditate often, because it helps you cultivate ethics. It's why it's important to cultivate ethics in your life, to have rules. It's important to be ethical in regards to our use of our requisites, the things that we need, the things that we use in our daily life. Food, clothing, shelter, not to live beyond our means, not to be greedy for more and more and greater and more luxurious possessions. So we have rules, we have guidelines for how to live our lives, reflecting on the use of our requisites when we eat, eating only to keep the body going, when we wear clothes, it's only to keep the body warm and to keep the body covered, and so on. The things that we use not to be too consumeristic or materialistic. It's important that we have right livelihood, that we live in a way that is ethical, not stealing to make a living, not lying to make a living, not killing to make a living, not selling drugs or alcohol or poison or weapons or human beings or so on. And finally, it's important that we guard our senses. So the most powerful form of ethics is to keep our senses guarded. Because this is where the desire to do and say bad things come from. And this is where meditation begins. When you close your eyes, you start to see that really reality is not all that complicated. You know, we hear scientists telling us about atoms and subatomic particles and strings and all sorts of crazy ideas about reality and how complicated it is, when in fact it's actually quite simple. Reality is only seeing, hearing, smelling, tasting, feeling, and thinking. Everything that you experience, everything in the universe, has to begin with one of these six things. And so this is where all of our problems have their beginning. If you have problems in your life and you'd like to maybe be a better person, maybe be a happier person, it all begins with the eye door, the ear door, and so on. And because they're unguarded, because we just react to things and we suffer, we cause suffering for others and we feel guilty, or we do things that harm ourselves, that upset our own mind. So altogether, this is sila, this is ethics, or right conduct, how we should conduct ourselves in our lives. Once you have that as a basis, then you begin to practice meditation. Then you have citta visuddhi, where your mind states become purified. It sounds like that should be the end, really. Citta visuddhi is where your mind becomes pure. And for many of us, that seems like, well, when you hear that, it sounds like that's the goal. For many people, that is as far as they get. They'll get to the point where they sit down and meditate and their mind becomes pure. And they think, well, I've attained the goal. And so it's important to understand that this, to put this purification in its place. This is only the second purification. You're not there yet. Why not? Because a pure mind state, is still only a temporary thing. You can cultivate the habit, but you have to work at it. You have to keep your mind pure. And as long as you work, as long as you come and meditate, you'll be able to get back to this state of purity. But when you leave here, when you stop meditating, and if you ever quit coming here to meditate, your mind will become impure again. Now, why is this? It's a very important point in Buddhism. You know, there was in ancient times there was a monk who an ascetic, not a monk, a bodhisattva, I think. And he went to stay with this king. He went, came down from the Himalaya to the Himalaya mountains to find salt. Usually, this is what they came for. And then the king saw him, and the king invited him to stay with him in the garden. Because of course kings like to have these wise people around so they can advise them in how to rule their kingdom and how to be successful. Kings like to have powerful sages around. So this monk had the most pure mind there was, or this ascetic, this rishi. They had the most pure mind, and this king was sure that this ascetic was enlightened. And so he invited him to stay, and he was diligent in feeding this monk and learning from him and understanding the things that he said. And they lived together quite happily for some time. But then one day the king had to go away for some time. He had to go and oversee some work in one of the outlying countries, outlying areas. And so he told his queen, he said, well, there's an ascetic staying in our garden, and every day I go and feed him. I want you to, can you please feed him while I'm gone? And the queen was fine with that. The queen was actually quite a wise woman, as well as quite beautiful. And so when the time came, this ascetic also had his magical powers, and he flew in through the window to where the king would normally be waiting to give him food, and the queen was waiting instead, and the queen had fallen asleep waiting for the ascetic to come. And when he came in through the window, he touched down on the floor, he made a little bit of noise, and she woke up and was startled, and her robe slipped. Of course, in those times everyone wore robes like this, so sometimes they would come loose, and her robe fell off, and she was standing there naked in front of this ascetic. And now he had spent many years up in the Himalaya mountains and then here in the garden, and he'd never had any sort of... He thought his mind was pure, and it seemed like his mind was pure, but when he saw this beautiful queen who was probably the most, I think maybe the most beautiful woman in the country, it says that desire came like a snake biting him in the heart. And he was speechless, and normally he would give a blessing. He couldn't give a blessing. She gave him the food, and he just stood there. She put her robe back on, of course, but she gave him the food, and he just stood there silently, and then he turned around and tried to fly through the window, and he couldn't fly anymore. He had lost his magical powers. He had lost his concentration, his focus. And the story goes on. Eventually he can't eat, he lies down sick and unable to eat, unable to think about anything except how much he wants to possess this queen. And the king comes back and he figures it out, and he goes and talks to the queen, and the queen is a very wise woman, and she says to the king, well, I'll figure it out, I'll find it. I'll solve this. And so the king gives the queen to this ascetic, and the ascetic becomes a layman, and they go off and he gives him a house, and he's so happy that now he possesses this queen and possesses his one true desire. And then the queen turns him into a servant boy, telling him, fetch this, do that, and back and forth to the castle, getting her things from her chambers and bringing them to the new house, and keeping him busy day in and day out, until finally she grabs him by his whiskers, because they had long beards, of course, the ascetics. And she says, look, you were once the most powerful ascetic in this country, and now look at you, you're a servant boy. Are you not ashamed of yourself? And he realized, oh, this is true, what am I doing? He realized that desire, these things, you can get what you want, but you always have all this work that you have to do to accomplish it. He realized what a fool he'd been. He realized that his mind wasn't pure, that there was more work to be done. So meditators are sometimes like this. We enter into very calm and peaceful states, but they don't last. And they don't last because they're not based on wisdom. Citta visuddhi is when your mind becomes calm, when your mind becomes quiet. This is important. It's an important stage in meditation for your mind to become quiet, for your mind to become clear, but it's only the beginning. We need the mind to be clear because we're going to now use it to cultivate wisdom. So this is the second visuddhi. The rest of the visuddhis are based on wisdom, based on this cultivation of understanding. The third one is ditthi visuddhi. So the doorway to wisdom. How you know that your meditation has moved beyond citta visuddhi, has moved beyond this mere calm, where you're just calm, right? So we're saying that calm is only the beginning. If that's all you get, if that's all you get out of the meditation, you haven't found the goal. How do we know when we've gotten beyond this? Ditthi. We begin to see things as they are. Ditthi means view. So we have many views and opinions about self and about ourselves, about the world, about good and bad, about right and wrong. We have lots of views, true and not true. All the religions of the world are based on views. We have views of this and that. And these views inform their actions and their speech. So most importantly, we have view of self. We have this view that I exist, that there is a self. And we view everything in this way. When you see a cup, you think of it as a cup, a thing, a self. That's what it is. It is a cup. When we see a person, we say, that's so-and-so, this person, that person. We think of them as a self, as an entity, as a thing. When we have a problem, we think of it as an entity, as a thing. And this is wrong. This is the real problem with our problems. Because you can't solve that. You either have it or you remove it. If a person is causing you problems, then the only answer is to not be involved with that person. If something is causing you a problem, get rid of it. And so this is how we approach our lives, trying to get the things that we want, trying to be free from the things that we don't want, but as we all know, we can't always have what we want. We can't always be sure that things are going to go the way we want. When we have a problem in our minds, when we're depressed or angry, we think of it as a problem. Worried, afraid. As long as we see things as entities, we have no solution. It's just try and avoid, always running away and always running towards. So in Buddhism, we learn to look at things differently. We learn to look at things not based on entities, not based on a self or a whole thing, but based on experiences, based on moments. So when you want something, when there's something that you want, suppose you see some beautiful, or you see some food that you like. You see a beautiful apple sitting on the table. It looks delicious. And you want that apple. In our meditation practice, we learn to look at that not as an apple, not as me seeing the apple, or what, but as the moments of experience, the seeing, the recognizing, the judging, the wanting, the scheming, and the chasing, moment by moment, how it develops. We break down all our problems into what's really, truly real. The apple doesn't exist. The apple's not the problem. Not having the apple isn't the problem. Wanting, the wanting. Wanting so many different things. If someone's yelling at you, the yelling isn't the problem. Yelling is just sound. And the words aren't the problem. Words are just words. The person isn't the problem. What are they doing? The problem is the reaction. The problem is we see it. We conceive of this. Hey, this person's yelling at me. We don't see that it's just sound. It's like birds chirping. If someone's yelling at you, it's just sound. The words are just words. And so ditti visuddhi is where we come to see things as they are. We come to see really what exists. That in reality, people don't exist, cups don't exist, I don't exist. All that exists is moments of experience. Like right now, you're sitting. So many experiences every moment. Maybe you feel pain from having to sit so long. Maybe you feel anxious because you're having to sit still, or you feel bored because I'm talking on and on. Maybe you like what I'm saying, maybe you don't like what I'm saying. All these things coming up, liking, disliking, restlessness, maybe happiness, maybe calm. Maybe you feel hot, maybe you feel cold, maybe you're listening to the sound of my voice, or the sound of the cars. You see things, you see the people around you, or you see images in your mind. Maybe you're thinking about things at home or at work. All of these things are real, moments of experience. This is important because it teaches us how we create problems. It teaches us the process of reality, the process of our experience. How we see things and then we like them or dislike them. We can watch how we create suffering for ourselves. We can watch how we ourselves hurt ourselves. And so we can learn to refine our behavior, our reactions. We can learn to refine our minds. This is very much beyond just a pure state of mind, because this cultivates purity of mind as a habit. As you start to see things clearly, you start to see how you're causing stress for yourself. Well, as a result, you naturally cause less stress for yourself. You're less likely to hurt yourself, to do things that cause suffering. This is ditti visuddhi. Ditti visuddhi leads to understanding. In Buddhism we have this idea of karma. So we all wonder, where does karma come into play? Karma means an action, right? So where is karma in all this? We think of karma as when you do or say bad things, right? That's bad karma. It's actually not. You can't do or say karma. Not in Buddhism. In Buddhism, karma is your intention, your state of mind. Killing is only wrong because you want to kill, you want to harm someone. It's a very bad mind state. If you have enough of it, you'll actually go and kill someone. Stealing is only wrong because you want to steal, because you know that this doesn't belong to you and yet you take it anyway. You betray someone's, or you ignore someone's right to possession. Things are only bad because of your mind. And so once you begin to see things as they are, you begin to see what's right and wrong. This is called kanka vitarana visuddhi. You give up any doubt of what's right and what's wrong. And we have all these doubts about which way to go, how we should live our lives, what's right, what's wrong. Meditation removes that doubt. You begin to see things clearly. Once you begin to see things clearly, you've attained the right path. You gravitate towards the right way of living your life. This is where we're headed, right? In the beginning, we're just learning what is the right path. What we want is to be on the path of pure. We want our minds to be pure. We want to be able to sit and be happy. We want to be able to walk and be happy. We want to be able to be at peace. We don't want to suffer. We don't want to worry. We don't want to fear. We don't want to be angry or depressed or bored or frustrated or addicted to so many different things. So this is, we're trying to find this path. Once we begin to see clearly, we lose any kind of uncertainty. We begin to see the path. And at this point in meditation, there's lots of wrong paths that we might take. So we see what we're doing wrong and we might start to take the wrong path. And so I won't go into detail, but there come two sets of phenomena. The first are good things. The first are bad things, actually. So this is what, when you sit for a long time, what you experience. You experience impermanence. You find it hard to meditate because your mind is changing. Your mind is chaotic. Your mind won't sit still. Also the body as well. You're comfortable, but then a moment later you're uncomfortable. It's not stable, so you get upset. Hard to sit still. You'll see suffering. You'll have pain and you'll have discomfort in the mind. It's not very comfortable sitting still. This is why listening to the Dhamma is so good for seeing the truth. Because you're forced to see it. When I first ordained, we had to listen every week. We do a meditation course, and every week we had to come and listen to a Dhamma talk in the main hall. So it was nice to get a break, to come out and listen to the Dhamma. But as a Westerner, I'd just begun to sit on the floor. And they made us sit on flat mats right in front of the teacher who was giving the talk. And we had to sit there with our knees up in the air. Aches and pain all over. And then the talk was in Thai. An hour long talk, hour and a half sometimes. And we didn't understand a word of it. Yeah. We had to sit through that. And boy, was it a good practice. Because you're sitting right in front of the teacher and he's looking down at you speaking, who knows what he's saying. Something profound, and you're fidgeting. That's not comfortable. And you can't control anatta, you can't control your body, you can't fix it, no? You can't keep your mind from wandering, you can't keep your body from aching. And you move and you think, well, that solves it, and then the aches come back. These are the bad things that you see. And so as a result, you tend to gravitate towards the good things. So you'll feel happy sometimes, you'll feel calm, you'll feel energetic sometimes, you'll feel awake sometimes. You'll see lights or colors or pictures and you'll chase after them because they're much better than dealing with the pain, sitting with the pain. They're much better than whatever else is going on. Having to deal with your distracted mind, it's much nicer to watch this movie going on with these images that I'm seeing, or lights or colors or whatever. And unfortunately, or rather importantly, the good things are not the path. The bad things are the path. It's unfortunate, really. It'd be nice if the path was all the good things, right? You could just sit and enjoy all the peace and calm that we experience, but that's not the path. Remember I said, e samago isuddhiya, what is the path of purification? When you see with wisdom, impermanence, suffering, and non-self. You have to gravitate towards those things. Why? Because that is what upsets us. Impermanence is what upsets us. Suffering is what upsets us. Non-self is what upsets us. These are aspects, these are characteristics of reality. You can't escape them. And yet we try our best to run away from them. This is why we seek out pleasure, because it's stable, it's pleasing, it's ours, we control, we possess these things, as me, as mine. We seek out all this, but it can't be. Nature is not like that. Nature is impermanent, it's unsatisfying, it's uncontrollable. This is what you begin to see, and until we can face it, we'll always be on the wrong path. We'll always just be going around in circles with our happy things, with our pleasant things, believing, convincing ourselves that this is true happiness, and then we stop and it disappears and we actually don't accomplish anything. So, magga magga jnana dasana visuddhi, knowledge and vision of what is and what is not the path. We have to remember the path is learning to see impermanent suffering and non-self and learning to let go of those things that we cling to. Learning to stop trying to find happiness in anything. There's no one thing that can make you happy. If your happiness is dependent on things, you'll always be disappointed. Because things can't make you happy. They come and they go, they change. And all they leave you with is addiction. All they leave you with is more desire for those things. That's it. That's what you get. Once you muster up the courage and the fortitude to face the unpleasantness, then you enter into the path. Then it actually becomes quite easy. Once you're resolute in facing your problems, instead of running away from them, in facing these things that we don't like, in coming to overcome your likes and dislikes, and to be flexible and to be content, to be free from the power that these things have over us, to hurt us, right? Because as long as you don't like impermanent things, the change, you know, as long as you can't handle change, as long as you can't handle unpleasantness, as long as you have to control everything, you'll be vulnerable. Vulnerable to these aspects of reality. Once you resolve to accept and to understand and to see these characteristics and let go of things, let go of the idea of permanence, satisfaction and control, then it becomes quite pleasant. Well, it becomes quite rewarding. This is where your mind begins to let up. This is the true path. Patipada jnana dasana visuddhi, where we actually get on the path. Up to that point, you weren't even on the path. Yeah? You're just trying to find it. Once you get on the path, then the magic starts happening. Your mind begins to let go. You begin to realize so many things. And there's a series of what we call the vipassana jnanas that you go through that are very profound. Profound realization of impermanence, suffering and non-self, meaning of letting go, of stopping trying to fix everything, trying to control everything, trying to have everything. And so I won't go into detail. This is where it actually gets, I can't talk about it. You have to experience for yourself. We have books that talk about all these jnanas, all these stages of knowledge, but they're useless. They're useless for you. They're useless for the practitioner. The practitioner, you have to realize them yourself. All I will say is when you practice this way, once you approach these characteristics and really try to see the truth instead of the way we want it to be and gravitating towards the good things, eventually you will let go. This is this prized concept of letting go. Oftentimes we have the wrong idea. We think letting go comes first, right? Letting go is the practice. Just let go. Yeah? Man, you got to learn to let go. Why don't you just let go? Man, you got to let go. Yeah? We say this. We think letting go is the practice. It's not. That's crucial. It's important to understand because letting go is the goal. Letting go is what we want. Letting go is like learning to dance with life. When you dance, it's not like boxing. In boxing, you try to defeat life and try to conquer life. We don't do that. When you dance, you are moving with the rhythm, with the flow of life. We're trying to learn to let go like being in a river. Let it come, let it go. Not cling. Because reality doesn't work that way. There's how we want things to be and then there's how it is. And they can never be totally in sync. Sometimes you can get what you want, but not always. So as long as you expect this or expect that, you'll always be subject to disappointment. You'll always be vulnerable. The only way to be truly invincible, truly completely perfect, is to let go. And letting go comes from seeing this. Seeing impermanence, seeing that everything changes, that you can't, seeing really, not intellectually, but seeing, I'm clinging to this and looking at it and say, oh wait, it's impermanent. Not intellectually, it doesn't work that way, it's not enough. I must stress, this isn't an intellectual thing, I'm describing something that you will experience. I'm not trying to teach you something that you should learn. I'm just warning you that you will come to a point where things will be impermanent. Well, right now you're starting to see things impermanent, suffering and non-self. That's the beginning of letting go. Because as you see that more and more, you'll start to see, wow, this is really just the nature of things. I can't escape this. I can't fix this. I can't make these things stable, satisfying, controllable. And you'll let go. You really will. And this is what it means to realize Nibbana. When we talk about Nirvana, it's not something mystical or mysterious or hard to understand. It just means letting go. When you stop clinging, when you stop holding on, then you become free. And that's the goal. That's when the king reaches his final destination from taking these series of relay chariots, one after the other, one leading to the other. So I think I've talked long enough. I'd like to thank you all for being patient and staying and listening. I'd like to wish you all success in your practice and happiness in your lives. And thank you again for inviting me. Have a good night. Was I loud enough?
Yeah, but I had to keep looking at you. I haven't let you sleep.
All right. Do you have any questions? Does anyone have any questions or comments about what I said? Anything that wasn't clear?
There are seven.
There are seven, yes.
You covered up two, four?
All seven. But I was going through them quickly, so I didn't want to bore you with the details. So let's sum it up. Sila visuddhi. The first one is you need to be sila. You know sila. That's the first. The second one is citta. So citta is samatha meditation, where it's samadhi, you know, where your mind becomes calm. The third one, ditti visuddhi, where you see what's really there. That's actually not final ditti, because that comes with nibbana. Samma ditti is in the Eightfold Noble Path, it's later. But ditti visuddhi means not looking at things as entities. Like this isn't a phone, this is seeing or thinking. No, it's in terms of it. So that's ditti visuddhi. Then number four, kankha vitarana visuddhi. Kankha, which means doubt. Vitarana means going over. So overcoming doubt. It has to do with what's right, what's wrong. You start to see right and wrong. So this has to do with karma, has to do with you know, so you see the way things are, but then you start to learn. As you see, it's not the only thing that happens. You start to see, this is good. This is bad. When I get angry, that's bad. When I'm mindful, that's good. So you start to learn that there are differences. Not everything is equal. Some things are good for you, some things are bad for you. That's kankha vitarana visuddhi. The next one is magga magga jnana dasana visuddhi. This is the Pali. Magga, the path. Amagga, not the path. And jnana dasana, knowledge and vision. Jnana dasana. So differentiating what is the path and what is not the path. That's number five. Once you figure that out, then you get on the path. Number six is patipada, when you practice, because you know the path. So that's when vipassana starts, when you go through the vipassana jnanas. And number seven is nibbana, jnana dasana visuddhi, like real knowledge and vision, when you see nibbana. That's in the... Could you hear me? Am I loud enough?
No, yeah.
Okay.
But some of the, especially the Pali,
yeah, well, I have a different pronunciation as well. But you don't need to learn. It's interesting to learn about, you know.
I have the book at home.
You have Visuddhimagga?
Yes.
You know, yes. That's what the Visuddhimagga is based on. Those seven Visuddhis. It separates it into three parts, right? The first one is Sila. The second one is samadhi, and 3, 4, 5, 6, 7 are panya. So they have the three nidesa in the Visuddhimagga, the book. And you can separate it like that. What is the Visuddhimagga? It's just sila, samadhi, panya. It's not anything new or foreign. It really is just those three. But panya has five parts.
Thank you.
You're welcome.
And please remember Saturday, this Saturday, 7:30 to 8, we have puja and maybe students of meditation. Then 8 to 9, Bhante Yutudhamo Dhamma.
8 to 9, for Saturday.
Saturday. Yeah.
In the morning?
No, afternoon.
Evening?
Yeah.
Bhante, you look very young.
Oh, yes. Well, thank you.
How long have you been into the Dhamma?
16 years. As a monk, 14 years. I'm still young.
So you, how did you come back?
Oh, well. I went to practice meditation. I went to stay in Thailand. I spent a month in a meditation center there. Walking and sitting. Oh, I wasn't anything special. I had a hard, hard time with it.
No, I know, but it takes a special kind of person. Because that's a difficult life. It's very difficult.
Well, yeah, to become a monk,
yeah.
I would agree. I don't want to, I'm not tooting my own horn, but not everyone is cut out to be a monk. I know because I've tried to get other people to ordain. not everyone. I don't think it's just to do with their punya. It's to do with, you know, we say parami or whatever. If they've, you have to have done some good karma, I think, in the past. I think I'm lucky to have done something. Maybe I gave robes to a monk or something. So I always give robes. Whenever I go to see a monk, I always give them robes because it, and then I make a determination, Adhisthana, may I be a monk, always be a monk.
Not someone told me that you make a Canadian monk.
Uh-huh.
Canadian monk in Sri Lanka. No, it could have been.
It could have been. There are others.
There are others too?
I think so. Not so many Canadians, of course, but.
Is it Canadian?
Could have been me. I was in Sri Lanka for 2 years. I stayed at Sambodhi Vihara. You know Sambodhi in Colombo 7? The Buddhist television? Kusladama Hamdro? Yeah, I stayed with him for some time.
My sister and brother-in-law, they opened they bought a temple in London.
Uh-huh.
So my sister and brother-in-law are very helpful in trying to get that set up properly.
Very good.
So, Kusadama Swami is the one who went forward and...
He's a nice guy.
Better get a picture